said Floyd. What on earth are you talking about? Maxine put a hand on her hip. You all are looking like we got panned before we even opened. Brandy Sainsbury handed over a thin booklet. This just came out. Hazel studied the cover over Maxine's shoulder, an illustration of a red hand about to clasp a microphone. Red Channels, the report of communist influence in radio and television. Hazel read the lines at the bottom of the page out loud. Published by Counterattack, the newsletter of facts to combat communism. Came out today. Floyd spoke quietly. It lists people in the entertainment industry who are linked to communism. Like who? Asked Maxine. Brandy rattled off names. Aaron Copland, Pete Seeger, Orson Welles, Lillian Hellman, Arthur Miller, Dorothy Parker. 151 people in all. And you? Maxine, who had been leafing through it while Brandy spoke, held up a page to Hazel. Me? Hazel took it from her. Like the other names, hers was followed by a list of offenses, all of which had occurred in the 1930s, signing a petition for the Scientific and Cultural Conference for World Peace, attending an anti-fascist rally, being a member of the Actors' Equity Association, having signed a congratulatory telegram to the Moscow Art Theater, and donating to a clothing drive for Spanish refugees. A couple of the entries were incorrect, listing organizations she'd never even heard of. What was wrong with attending an anti-fascist rally? Hazel looked to Maxine, confused. That's who we went to war against. They say these are all communist fronts. Brandy again. Look at this last one. Hazel pointed to a line on the page. It was a clothing drive. I gave away an old coat. This is utterly ridiculous. So it is. Maxine took the booklet from her hands and tossed it onto the bar. The others stared at it as if it were radioactive. Maxine shook her head. This will all blow over. The more Hazel thought about it, the more outraged she became. But it's not right. Who published this? A company called American Business Consultants. Brandy shrugged. Their heart is in the right place. They don't want communists to infiltrate our country and destroy democracy. Hazel disagreed. But you can't go after people who are innocent in order to scare everyone else out of their wits. It's just fear-mongering. Floyd spoke quietly. They're not kidding about this stuff. Look at what happened to the Hollywood Ten. 3 years earlier, in a challenge to free speech, a group of Hollywood screenwriters had refused to reveal whether or not they were communists. The case had made its way through the courts, but lost a chance to appeal when two Supreme Court justices died within a couple of months of each other, tilting the court to the right. Several of the Hollywood Ten had recently begun serving prison sentences for contempt. They're trying to scare us, Hazel said. She didn't have to add that it was working. They're basically saying that if you wanted to help out with war relief, or if you were for a good relationship with Russia, back when we were allies of Russia, fighting on the same side, I might remind you, you're now an enemy of America. That, my friends, is what's un-American, not this stupid pamphlet of rumors and falsehoods. The people around them burst into applause. She hadn't meant to make a speech, but she was their director. If she didn't speak up, who would? That's right, said Floyd. If Hazel's a communist, then I'm one too. We must all stand together. More cheers. Hazel, can I talk to you for a moment? Brandy had sidled up to Hazel and linked arms with her. Hazel allowed her to pull her off to the side, away from the group. What's going on, Brandy?
Everything's great. I love the play. It's amazing. I mean, you're so talented.
Thank you.
I consider myself so lucky to be part of this team. Really lucky.
Hazel waited.
I hate to complain about anything, but...
Brandy took a breath.
Well, it's about my costume. Floyd showed me the sketch, and I just don't look good in that color, and trust me, I have a really good eye. I know what works on me and what doesn't. I tried to explain that, but he said my first choice didn't fit with the show's palette.
What's your first choice?
Tangerine.
Hazel smiled. With all the drama going on in the world, it was a strange relief to have to consider the color of a dress. Well, you know, it's really up to the costume designer. They get the final say, as they have to make outfits that work together on stage. If they allowed every actor to have a preference, the play won't look as good. It would be visual chaos.
I would think you have the final say, as director and all.
Floyd was staring at them from across the room on the alert. Obviously, they'd already had some kind of tiff. Hazel nodded for him to come over. She didn't want Brandy to think she could bulldoze her way into getting what she wanted, or Floyd to think she talked behind people's backs.
Ladies?
Floyd, Brandy was explaining that she has an issue with the color of her costume.
You mean the aubergine dress that will fit her like a glove?
Brandy shook her head.
In the sketch, the dress is purple. I hate purple. It makes me look sallow and fat.
It's a lush, deep hue, I promise, insisted Floyd. The color of a sweet plum, just like you. The flattery was lost on Brandy. She crossed her arms.
I look much better in bright colors, like tangerine.
Floyd shook his head. Orange? No. I cannot have you parading around in orange. The rest of the cast is in cool tones. You'll stand out like a garish citrus fruit.
Better than an ugly eggplant.
Hazel had to shut down this verbal food fight. Let's wait and see the dress once Floyd is finished with it, all right? If you really don't like it, we'll reconsider. Brandy reluctantly agreed before flouncing off. That girl is used to getting her way, said Floyd. Should I just dye the dress in a big vat of orange and get it over with?
Not at all. I'll handle her, don't you worry. Let's just hope this is our biggest dilemma.
3 days later, North Korea declared war on South Korea. Hazel tore through the newspaper articles, alarmed at the thought of another war. The North Koreans were backed by Russia, the South Koreans by America. The country would become a proxy for a larger conflict, communism versus democracy. Of that, Hazel had no doubt. For her brother and his friends, who came of age in the 1930s, communism as a philosophy was all the rage, and Ben had jumped on the bandwagon right off, following the lead of brilliant writers like Clifford Odets and Albert Maltz. Practically everyone who was in a creative field looked to communism as a way to even out the gross misbalances of society, especially after the Depression exposed the wide rift between the rich and the poor. At least once a week, Ben knocked on her bedroom door, some petition or other in hand, and asked her to add her name to it. Most of the time, she never even bothered to read it. Everyone was taking up causes and trying to impose change, and she was happy to follow Ben's lead and take part. At his urging, she joined in marches, like the one to support the Spanish Republicans against Franco. News of the violence and horror in Spain, of executions of anyone thought to be a communist, including priests, had spread to the United States, and Ben and his buddies had embraced the cause. That afternoon, they'd marched and shouted, and then crowded into someone's basement apartment to go over next steps. She'd never seen her brother so engaged, his face shining with purpose, until he'd been drafted into the army and was heading off to his own war and his own death. Now there would be more boys sent abroad to a foreign country who'd never traveled anywhere outside of the United States and would be in a strange land told to fight and kill people, like the soldiers she'd met in Naples. Shaking off the dark thoughts, she headed down to the hotel lobby to meet Maxine for brunch. Mr. Bard stood in the middle of the space, overseeing two workers who were hanging an enormous oil painting above the fireplace. She stopped and studied it.
Very nice.
By one of our sixth-floor tenants. Couldn't pay rent, but I figure this will cover a couple of months.
His graciousness touched her. That's very kind of you.
Did you see the feds outside?
What?
Been there the past week or so, on and off. Could be any one of our guests who they're after, other than Mr. Stolberg, of course. Wonder if he's the one who sent for them.
He scratched his chin and surveyed the painting.
Pull the right side up 2 inches.
He nodded.
Great.
Has anyone asked them what they're doing there?
The workers climbed down their ladders and folded them up.
Watch that. Don't scratch the floors.
Mr. Bard turned back to Hazel.
Nah, why bother? They go through the garbage, they tap our phones. We know it, and they know we know it. Just like Hungary, where I came from. I'm used to it. You Americans think it's all so free, but no one's free.
Out on the street, Hazel peered around. A black sedan was parked next to the fire hydrant, unoccupied and unticketed. Maxine stumbled out of the hotel, a scrape of mascara down one cheek, which Hazel wiped off with a handkerchief. Long night? The usual. Even Maxine managed to look alarmed when Hazel told her about the feds staking out the hotel, listening in on their phone calls. She glanced at the car before taking Hazel by the arm.
I don't know about you, but I could use a sangria. Unbelievable. You never stop, do you?
They did an about-face and headed into the street entrance of El Quijote, the Spanish restaurant located in one of the hotel's former dining rooms. The interior decor was best described as Iberian bordello, featuring red leather seating, a long, dark bar peppered with fake Tiffany pendants, and rough, adobe-style walls that would leave a scratch if you got too close. The place was huge, with rooms off of rooms. They grabbed a couple of seats at the bar. A few tables were filled with folks who looked like they'd accidentally stumbled in, but the place was otherwise empty. This was way too early in the morning for the restaurant's usual clientele. Lavinia Smarts sat at a table way in the rear, talking to an older man. She waved at them before turning back to her conversation. "She's so regal," said Maxine, sliding onto a bar stool. "That's what I want to be like when I'm her age. A doyen."
"No one messes with Lavinia," said Hazel.
As she said the words, she spied a man in a black suit in a shadowy corner of the restaurant. He was scribbling in a notebook, and when he wasn't writing, he was staring right at Lavinia. She elbowed Maxine. "Don't be obvious about it, but that man seems like he's surveilling our friend." Maxine pretended to drop a napkin and eyed the man as she picked it up from the floor.
"That was so obvious, Max!"
Hazel almost laughed. "Seriously, no one would ever guess you were an actress." The man turned away, so they couldn't get a good look at his face. "You're worried for nothing. He's probably an accountant who wishes he was a writer and comes here to soak up the poetic atmosphere," said Maxine. Lavinia rose and hugged her friend goodbye before disappearing through the side door that connected the restaurant to the hotel lobby. As she did so, the man snapped the notebook shut and pulled out his wallet, tossing a few bills down on the table before trailing her. Hazel stood, pulling Maxine along with her. "No, he's up to no good." In the lobby, there was no sign of either Lavinia or her tail, and the elevator was slowly ascending. Instead of waiting, they hoofed it up the stairway. At the third floor, Hazel peered up over the railing. She loved this view. Straight up, the ornate railing wrapping around and around and disappearing into the blinding whiteness of the skylight. Fancy and overdone, as if she were in Paris or London. But this time, a few floors above, the man in black was looking right back down at her. She withdrew fast and whispered to Maxine, "He saw me. He's up there." They picked up the pace, trying to walk as quietly as possible. But as their steps quickened, the man's did also. Around and around they went until they heard a bang. "The door to the roof." Hazel stopped. "We have him trapped."
"I'm not sure we should follow him. What if he's got a gun?"
Hazel thought of Lavinia. The very least they could do was show these men that they weren't afraid, that the hotel residents would stand up for one another and resist such intrusion. "We're just a couple of girls getting some sun. Come on." They pushed through the heavy door. The man stood near one of the gables, looking down over the avenue as if he was searching for his ride. When he saw them, he took off his hat and fanned his face, an attempt at nonchalance. Hazel looked about. No one else was up there with them. She made a beeline for him. "Who are you?" Up close, he was younger than she'd expected, and rather skinny. His nose was slightly too big for his face, above rose-colored lips that belonged on a girl. His unruly thatch of brown hair could use a barber. This guy sure didn't seem like a fed. He looked from Maxine to Hazel, as frightened as a chicken. Hazel stuck her hands on her hips. "Are you a fed? If so, you're a disgrace to the agency, going after a sweet old lady. We saw you, and the residents of the hotel don't tolerate being spied on."
"I'm not a fed."
His voice was deeper than Hazel expected. Oh, please, everyone in the hotel knows we're being watched. Hazel studied him. Even though the morning was cool, sweat beaded down the man's temple. The walk up the stairs had winded Hazel, but not that much. We saw you taking notes about Lavinia Smarts. He tugged at his collar, as if trying to catch his breath.
I'm not a fed.
The words were barely audible.
I work in the private sector.
What does that mean? Maxine asked. He grimaced, as if he had some kind of tic, but didn't respond. Something was off.
We seem to have stumped him, said Maxine.
To Hazel's surprise, the man slowly listed to one side before sliding to the ground, a clump of boxwood breaking his fall. Not what Hazel had expected. What on earth? Did he just faint? They bent low over him, unsure of what to do next. He passed out, said Hazel.
No, he's having a fit.
Maxine was right. The man had gone rigid, his mouth parted, eyes open and looking off to the side. His body shook as if he were in a washing machine, and his lips began to turn blue. Hazel turned to Maxine.
Go down and call for someone. Have them send for help. I'll be right back.
Maxine rushed off. Hazel had no idea what to do. She tried to hold his head to keep him from hitting it on the base of the planter. He was unreachable, his eyes rolled back and a horrible grimace on his mouth. She knelt down, the gravel of the roof digging into her knees, her mouth dry, and pulled his head and shoulders onto her lap. As the man's vibrations coursed through her, she murmured calm words, as soothing as possible, to try to draw him out of his trance. Chapter 9. Hazel. June 1950. The man lying in Hazel's lap seemed only to get worse. A trail of drool dripped down the side of his chin, and the sound of his teeth grinding set her own on edge. She looked around, desperate for help, even though she knew she was all alone on the sprawling rooftop. For a while he fought against her, as if trying to get to his feet, so in a low voice she told him to quiet down, that everything was fine. With a great gasp, he sat upright, almost knocking Hazel in the head as he did so. He wasn't fully conscious, but his breathing began to return to normal, and the color slowly came back to his face.
Where am I?
When he finally spoke, his voice was low, weary, like that of a much older man. On the roof of the Chelsea Hotel, you had some kind of a fit. He blinked a couple of times and looked about.
God, no.
She kept her hand on his back, unsure of what to do next.
You fell pretty hard. Are you hurt?
I don't think so. He rolled his shoulders a few times. Someone's gone for help.
What happened to you just now?
He looked defeated, worn.
Epilepsy.
Is it because we chased you up the stairs? Hazel couldn't believe she was actually feeling bad for the guy.
It just happens.
Does it happen often? He put one hand on the back of his neck and rubbed it.
Not in years, since I was in high school. It's what kept me from the draft.
She guided him onto a nearby bench and sat beside him, like a couple of strangers waiting for a bus. Uncertain, she said the first thing that came to mind.
You were following Lavinia Smarts, right?
He nodded, barely.
Why are you spying on people? There's no one evil or dangerous here, just a bunch of artists and writers and actors.
I'm not spying. I was just inquiring. We're trying to keep America safe. His face fell. Apparently I haven't done a very good job of it.
That was pretty terrifying.
I'm sorry you had to see me like that.
She knew she should let him recover, but in her nervousness and her relief that he was okay, she couldn't seem to stop talking.
How old are you?
25.
You seem younger. He took out a handkerchief and wiped his mouth.
I guess it doesn't help when I'm drooling like a baby.
You only drooled a little. She patted his knee, then immediately regretted it.
I hardly noticed.
The corners of his mouth rose slightly.
I appreciate that.
The door to the stairway banged open, and Maxine and Mr. Bard appeared.
What's your name?
Asked Hazel.
Charlie.
Look, I really don't want to cause a scene. I'll lose my job. Again, I'm sorry about this. I'll just go. By the time Maxine and Mr. Bard reached them, Charlie was back on his feet. He tucked the handkerchief into his pocket and addressed Hazel. "Thank you for helping me. I appreciate it, but I must go now." His strides lengthened as he crossed the rooftop, then disappeared into the black hole of the stairway. "What should we do?" asked Maxine. Mr. Bard shrugged.
"What can we do? We're the little people. They're the ones in power. We do what they say."
Hazel spoke up. "He's not a threat, believe me. He's mortified by what happened. My guess is we won't see him around here again."
"If you say so," answered Maxine.
"In the meantime, should we go and tell Lavinia what's going on? She'll want to know." Downstairs, Lavinia was nestled in an apricot-colored armchair in her living room, a script spread open on her lap and a pair of reading glasses perched on her nose. Winifred and Wanda sat at a table near the window, playing a game of checkers. Lavinia listened to Hazel's recounting of the morning's events without interrupting, glancing over at Maxine every so often.
"I don't think we'll see him again," said Hazel. "He was awfully embarrassed, but I bet there's more where that came from."
Lavinia closed the script and set it on the floor.
"What bothers me most is not that I'm a target, but that by infiltrating the hotel, they're destroying everything that Chelsea stands for, where people with opposing opinions can mingle and mix without forcing one side or the other to leave. It's the beauty of the place, has been so for decades. The same goes for Broadway."
Maxine leaned back in the sofa. "Broadway and New Yorkers won't put up with this insanity for long. It'll blow over fast, I'm guessing."
"I'm not so sure," said Hazel. "The House Un-American Activities Committee successfully crushed the Hollywood Ten, which has only encouraged that awful Senator McCarthy in his fanatical hunt for communists in the government. Who knows who's next after that? Artists? Musicians? We're right in the HUAC's crosshairs. I can't help but think that if we band together, we can show them that we won't be bullied," said Hazel.
"You mean like the Hollywood Ten banded together?"
Wanda's voice was barely a whisper. Winifred finished her thought.
"They ended up going to prison."
The sisters had a good point.
"What about going to our unions?" said Hazel. "Aren't they there to protect us?"
"Good luck with that," answered Lavinia. "The Screen Actors Guild caved 3 years ago, and I have no doubt AFTRA will do the same."
She looked dolefully down at the script on the floor.
"No doubt I'm next with my history. If I get named, there goes my starring role on the small screen."
"What starring role?" asked Hazel.
"I'm to play a family matriarch in a new television series on NBC. A juicy part, to say the least."
Congratulations rang out around the room.
"What will become of us if the classically trained Madame Lavinia stoops to television work?" teased Maxine.
"I'm getting old. Older. It would be nice to cut down on travel, do less regional theater, although I'd miss your grandmother's apple cake."
Lavinia turned to Hazel.
"Maxine's grandmother made all the treats that were sold during the intermission at Seattle Rep. I still dream of that cake."
"Being German and something of a battle axe, my grandmother didn't have many friends," added Maxine. "But she was always welcome at the theater, and has a special place in her heart for Lavinia. She'll be very sorry if you stop performing there."
The apartment door opened, and Virgil Thompson walked in.
"What on earth is going on in here?"
Hazel gestured around the room. "We're trying to figure out a way to fight back against the blacklist."
"A ghastly premise for a get-together."
He patted her on the head.
"On principle, I don't tolerate discussions of politics or religion. I don't tolerate complainers. It all bores me to tears."
"We're not complaining. We're standing up for something." But he'd already wandered over to the bar cart and didn't hear a word she'd said. The soothing repetition of rehearsals helped Hazel move forward. The play was gradually taking shape under her hand. The process was no different from that of a sculptor. But instead of wet clay, she maneuvered actors around a stage. First, the table read. A scene was discussed and characters considered from all angles, usually a demonstration of pseudo-intellectual posturing, although every so often a small nugget of truth hit home. Then the actors took to their feet and stumbled around on stage, bumping into one another, struggling with words, a mangled mess of a thing that left everyone panicked. This week, though, the actors had been told to be off book. No more scripts. The fear of not knowing the lines overcame nearly everyone, with actors calling out for help from the stage manager when they lost their way, apologizing profusely as the scene ground to a halt. But by the third or fourth run-through of a scene, the emotion under the words began to bubble to the surface. For a minute or two, speech and movement coalesced into a sublime tension. Whenever that happened, the cast would turn to Hazel afterward with the expectant smiles of good school children waiting to be patted on the head. The only cloud in the creative process was Hazel's worry that her listing in red channels and the threat of others being listed was dividing the cast. When a couple of the actors whispered in one corner during a break, every so often looking up and scanning the rest of the group, she couldn't help wondering if they were merely gossiping or guessing at who was a communist sympathizer. Another time, when Brandy and Hazel started walking toward the stage door at the same time during a break, Brandy said she'd forgotten something and suddenly turned back. Did she not want to be seen to the outside world as being too chummy with Hazel? Hazel tried to shrug it off as her own silly insecurities. Until Mr. Canby showed up early to a meeting of the show's designers at the theater with a grim look on his face. He tossed the latest issue of Variety on the work table, where Floyd's sketches were scattered around a model of the set.
They're closing in.
Hazel picked it up. Who is?
Read the headline.
She did so out loud. Un-American Activities Group probing radio, TV, stage.
Stage. That's us.
Mr. Canby took out a handkerchief and wiped his brow. She scanned the first paragraph. The House Un-American Activities Committee is heading east and soon will be initiating a probe of communism within the Broadway theaters of New York City. Committee investigators are already on the ground in the Big Apple, investigating suspected actors and writers, as well as gleaning information from others claiming to have facts about commie influences in Manhattan's showbiz. The pattern for the Broadway probe will be no different from that of the Hollywood hearings. The HUAC expects several former members of the Communist Party to come forward and purge themselves by answering questions and naming those they knew in the party.
Purge.
Mr. Canby let the word hang in the air.
That's some word. They've already started interviewing people in secret.
Floyd and the set designer were downstairs in the basement, checking to see if any old props could be retooled for the show, and Hazel was grateful they weren't in earshot. She didn't want them to see Mr. Canby so anxious.
I don't know anyone who's been interviewed.
Because they're secret, doll.
The article would certainly strike even more fear into the hearts of the theater community, everyone wondering if a rival was turning on them, if they were a target, if they'd go off to jail and lose everything. An insidious, poisonous fog was drifting down Broadway, across stages and into producers' offices and rehearsal rooms, making everyone suspect and scared.
"What can I do to help you, to help our production?" she asked.
He shook his head.
"Nothing. I mean, that's what you should do. Nothing. Don't speak out. Don't talk about it with other people. Lay low."
"What about the radio interview Maxine and I are supposed to do this afternoon?"
Canby had arranged for an on-air interview at NBC, and Hazel hated to admit how eager she was to return to the studio as a budding playwright, as opposed to a cow.
"You'll still do that, of course. We need all the good press we can get."
Canby's expression softened.
"Don't get me wrong. I believe in this show. This is the best thing I've produced in decades. Screw Butterfield Supermarkets."
"I'm sorry, what?"
"Butterfield Supermarkets. Some upstate grocery chain owned by an amateur blacklister. He enjoys organizing boycotts of anything slightly pinko. Lawrence Butterfield has decided the theater is his next pet project."
Floyd and the set designer emerged from the wings just then, preventing Hazel from asking any more questions. She dove headlong into the agenda, knowing that they had only an hour before the rest of the cast assembled, and Mr. Canby headed off after giving a nod of approval to both sets and costumes. As Floyd and the set designer were packing up to go, the rest of the cast drifted back in for the afternoon's rehearsal. The air in the room seemed to chill even before Hazel realized that two men in dark suits were charging down the aisle. This could not be good. She desperately wished Mr. Canby were still here.
"Yes, can I help you?"
Hazel tried to stay calm, put a neutral expression on her face.
"We're investigators with the FBI."
The one who addressed her had an angry landscape of razor burn across his neck. In tandem, the men flashed their badges before tucking them back into the inside pockets of their jackets.
"What do you want?"
"We were informed that Floyd Jenkins is here."
Floyd stepped forward, clutching a folder with his sketches in front of his chest like armor.
"Yes? You want me?"
His voice rose almost to a falsetto. The other man, a bear of a guy in a too-small suit that pulled at the seams, nodded.
"We'd like to ask you some questions downtown. Come with us, please."
"What is this all about?" said Hazel. "You can't just come and take him away. We're working here."
"Actually, ma'am, we can, if you'll come with us, please, Mr. Jenkins."
The room froze.
"Floyd, let me call Mr. Canby. Don't go anywhere," said Hazel, starting down the steps from the stage.
"No, no." Floyd waved his hand. "It's fine. It'll be fine." He handed the folder to Hazel.
"See that these get back to the costume shop, to my assistant. Tell her we have the green light and to get to work."
"No, Floyd, it's fine. I'll answer their questions and be back in no time." With the agents flanking Floyd on either side, they disappeared up the aisle.
"Maxine Mead, you are an absolute delight." The host of the radio program leaned in close to his microphone. "I know all our listeners out there are entranced, and if only they could see you like I do, they'd be panting like dogs."
Not exactly the way Hazel would have liked him to put it, but at least so far the radio interview had gone smoothly, with all the focus on Maxine. Hazel hadn't been able to reach Mr. Canby to tell him of the FBI spiriting Floyd off to be interviewed, but their own interview had only 5 minutes to go, after which she could head right over to his office.
"Now, Miss Ripley,"
the host swiveled around to Hazel,
"you've come out of nowhere, it seems, and now will be not only directing your first Broadway show, you also wrote it. How can you explain your good luck?"
"Well, you have to remember I understudied on Broadway for several years, so I know the theater world pretty well. And, as Maxine explained, it came out of our experiences during World War II in Naples."
"Right. Now, tell us what your little skit is all about."
Unbelievable. She doubted they'd call a male playwright's work a little skit, even if it were a debut. She soldiered on. "It takes place in a formerly grand hotel in an unnamed country that's under siege, and the guests are trapped inside by the fighting. They start turning on each other in fear and desperation and make assumptions about each other that aren't necessarily true. I'd say the general theme touches on the dangers of making assumptions about someone's identity and political beliefs."
"Intriguing. That's a big subject to tackle, especially now. I hate to bring this up, but your name turns up in red channels, which, if our listeners don't know, is a list of people suspected of being communist sympathizers. What do you have to say to that?"
She looked over at Maxine, who'd turned gray. "I advise everyone to ignore it. It's all hearsay." The host was only getting started, it seemed. He pulled a sheet of paper from his notes.
"I also have here a letter from a producer in the Theater Guild saying that you shouldn't be directing a Broadway show since you've been listed in red channels. It says that a half dozen Theater Guild subscribers were unhappy to see the employment of a controversial artist."
This was news to Hazel. The incrimination seemed to be coming faster and faster. She couldn't help but wonder if William Williams wasn't behind this, trying to stir up trouble ever since he'd quit as director.
"I won't bother to defend myself against the spurious allegations you just mentioned," she said. "In fact, I'm surprised, as a member of the press, you'd give them any credence without checking your facts first."
"I'm just repeating what I've heard."
After watching Floyd be taken away, Hazel couldn't take Mr. Canby's advice and stay under the radar, not when she'd just been ambushed. This time, she'd channel Maxine's innate courage and speak the truth loud and clear. May I remind you and your listeners that we have something called the First Amendment, the right to free speech? Directing a play should have nothing to do with my political views. America is a free country, after all. Am I right? Before he could respond, Maxine launched into a long monologue about the difference between acting in a movie and acting on stage, not letting the host get a word in edgewise. The clock ticked down until there were only 10 seconds to go. So be sure to come see Wartime Sonata, Maxine said. Previews start July 12th. Opening night is July 21st. See you at the theater. Hazel threw her headphones down on the table with Maxine following suit, and together they walked out without another word.
Chapter 10. Maxine. June 26, 1950. Hotel living definitely has its perks, especially when I camp out in the lobby and watch Mr. Bard's reactions to every tenant passing by. You can tell immediately those he loves and those he abhors. If he loves them, he calls out a nickname, sometimes dearie, and other times some kind of Hungarian endearment that sounds like it consists of all consonants. If he hates them, he'll scurry into his office rather than suffer their presence. Worse off are the folks who owe him rent money. Those he'll follow to the elevator, standing too close as it makes its slow descent, and speak about their monetary delinquency in a stage whisper that I'm sure he hopes will shame the poor resident into ponying up. I was waiting in the lobby because I was tired of staring at my phone upstairs, wondering if it would ring. Not surprisingly, Arthur had resurfaced more than once. The first time, he was standing across the street from the Biltmore, wearing a black fedora and matching raincoat. My eye went to him immediately. It always has. He nodded, but didn't beckon to me. And I jumped into a cab and escaped as fast as I could, heart pounding. He was outside the Chelsea the next time, holding a bunch of flowers, peonies, my favorite. We spoke, briefly. He was back in town for business, but said he couldn't let me go, that he'd do anything to make it up to me. We made a date to talk further, and it was then he pulled out all the stops, bringing me to a glitzy nightclub, ordering champagne. My grandmother had adored Arthur from the start, even though I was only 16. "I met your grandfather when I was a teenager," she told me. "It's better that way." I asked her why, and she just smiled. She kept a photo of them on their wedding day on her bureau, and I used to creep into her room and study it. In it, they were looking at each other, laughing. My grandmother's profile as delicate as a movie star's, and my grandfather's eyes filled with longing. The same way Arthur looked at me that evening at the nightclub. Arthur talked of our shared history, pleaded with me not to let our story end like this, promised that he'd changed and we were meant for each other. Even though I knew it was only a matter of time before he wore me down and we were back to performing our sordid duet, I'd said I wasn't ready and walked out. "What are you doing lurking in the lobby?" Hazel appeared out of nowhere, wearing a prim shirt dress with a matching cardigan, like she was off to church or something. I avoided her question with one of my own. "Where are you headed this fine evening?" "Family dinner. Would rather jump in the Hudson, but duty calls. My mom's still sore that I moved out, although I stop by once a week to try to make it up to her." She let out a funny sound, a cross between a hiccup and a gasp. "Hey, you should come along. Do you want to meet my parents? My mother will love you." She didn't wait for me to reply. "This is perfect. Come on." I agreed, curious, not that I had anything better to do. "Any news on Floyd?" I asked as the cab roared uptown. Yesterday, we'd hightailed it over to Canby's office right after the radio show and found him already on the phone with NBC, chewing them out for their attack on Hazel. He'd taken the news about Floyd badly, throwing a coffee mug across the room, and promised to track him down, do whatever it took. Nothing yet. I'm sure we'll hear soon, though. I didn't answer. None of us knew how these new rules worked, where someone could be taken away for questioning and then disappear, as if we were living under siege in some authoritarian state, not America. The taxi dropped us off outside one of those grand Upper West Side apartment buildings that take up the whole block. Hazel nodded to the doorman keeping guard just inside the gates, and we took a sharp left, up a flight of wide stairs. She shoved open a door, and we were standing inside what felt like a rambling country house, not a New York apartment. An expansive foyer with a mosaic floor opened up to a dark wood library on one side and some kind of salon on the other, both with big fireplaces. Hallways led off other hallways, a maze of sharp turns and hidden nooks. Hazel hung her hat and coat on the rack, and I followed suit. "This is your home?" "Yes. Back in the 1920s, when they moved in, it wasn't a big deal. Everyone lived like this. Lucky for them, it's rent-controlled. Otherwise, they might have to move in with me." She rolled her eyes. "Oh, Mr. Bard would adore them, I'm sure." Inside the kitchen, the aroma of a roast chicken greeted us. Her mother was stooped over, lifting it out of the oven, and when she caught sight of me, she squealed and dropped the roasting pan with a large crash. She left it there, the chicken half in the pan and half on the floor, and dashed over, wiping her hands on her apron. "You're Maxine Mead, a true star, here in our home." Hazel's mother had the same blue eyes as her daughter, but they darted back and forth, studying me closely. Her jowls hung heavy on her face, as did the skin under her eyes, forming translucent half-moons. Hazel was on her knees, cleaning up the mess and wiping the chicken's backside with a towel. "This will be fine. It wasn't on the floor for long." I moved to help, but her mother held me firmly by my elbows. "Maxine Mead, in the flesh! Nice to meet you, Mrs. Ripley." "That's right. Hazel said she acted with you in Italy." Mrs. Ripley turned to her husband, who sat in a wheelchair by the table. "Remember? Hazel acted with Maxine Mead in the USO tour." Her father, a skinny man with bony knees under his two big slacks, nodded but stayed silent. Hazel made the introductions, and then Mrs. Ripley was off to the races, offering me a glass of wine and asking all about Hollywood. I swear, she used the word starlet at least four times. We sat down and ate dinner, me answering her questions, and Hazel looking quite pleased with herself and not saying a word. Unlike me, that girl shied away from attention, and now I knew why. Attention in this household was fierce. "Hazel wanted to be an actress, but she wouldn't listen to me." Mrs. Ripley passed me the bowl of peas. "If she had taken my advice, she'd be in your position, doing movies and the like. I made Mr. Ripley's career, you see, so I know of what I speak." I looked over at Hazel, who stayed silent. "Hazel is a wonderful actress," I offered. Mrs. Ripley shook her head. "I wouldn't know. I've never seen her act. Not once. She's a bit of a joke in the theater world. Always the bridesmaid. You know that saying?" I was well aware of Hazel's run as an understudy and resented her mother for throwing it in her face. She seemed to take it personally, as if Hazel had refused to go on stage to spite her. There was no inquiry into her daughter's play or acknowledgement of the fact that Hazel's work was soon to be performed on Broadway. The blinders on that woman annoyed the hell out of me. After dinner, Mrs. Ripley attended to her husband, and I wandered around, eventually finding Hazel sitting in one of the bedrooms, looking out the window onto the rooftops of the city, the sky lit up with the last blast of sunset. The room still smelled slightly boyish, a lingering hint of sweat and hormones. Or maybe that was just my imagination. Was this Ben's room? Hazel nodded, her hands folded in her lap. How did you meet him? We hadn't spoken much of him. I didn't want to, as I barely knew her brother at all. I'm sure she wanted some dramatic love story, but that's not what it was. Far from it. We were just kids, moving along in the world. In a coffee shop, downtown. We dated here and there, but it wasn't anything serious. I don't really remember much about him, to be honest. I'm sorry. What about the other man? He's back, isn't he? Of course Hazel would know. She'd been watching me on stage day after day. Surely the resurgence of Arthur registered in my body language, my voice. Hazel, of all people, would know that. He is. Arthur's in the city on business. I tried to fend him off, but he's persistent. I finally agreed to meet him, and we talked. He feels awful about what happened. Why do you like him so much? He doesn't respect you.
Why don't you tell your mom to respect you? She's awfully rude.
I hadn't meant to be so abrupt, but Hazel considered her answer before speaking. She believes she knows the best way to go about things and gets frustrated when I don't listen. She was upset when I moved into the Chelsea and feels abandoned. First Ben, then me.
You're only a cab ride away, and you're an adult, for God's sake. Does she really feel abandoned, or is it just that you made an independent decision without consulting her?
What do you mean?
Your mother is one of those people who comes across as selfless and caring, but only so others will recognize and laud her martyrdom. She craves control.
That's a horrible thing to say.
Hazel's tentative delivery didn't match the admonishment. She had to know it was true deep down.
At least she doesn't hurt me.
The dig at Arthur hit home. You so sure of that? It doesn't just have to be physical, you know.
We sat quietly, a detente of sorts. My mother has been through so much, she finally explained. I guess I see it as my daughterly duty and try not to let it bother me. How did you and Arthur meet?
I appreciated Hazel maneuvering the conversation to a less fraught subject. He knew the couple who ran Seattle Rep and would often stop by and help out. All the girls had a crush on him. I couldn't help but smile at the memory. The smell of the theater, a mix of wood shavings and pipe smoke, came back to me in a rush. I was 16 and he was 21, with this curly dark hair and blue eyes. What a combination. A tough guy, all muscles and cragginess, except for those eyes. Anyway, I'd finally gotten a decent role in a play where I had to sing and dance. No one expected me to land that part, but I'd been practicing day after day, really putting in the work. The other girls hated me for getting it and tortured me to no end. Whispered backstage as I was rehearsing, hid my costumes and makeup.
That's terrible.
Hazel sat back against the headboard and wrapped her arms around her knees.
What did you do?
What could I do, really? The night of the first performance, they smeared lipstick on my shirt. I tried to get it off best I could, but
Then I had to go on stage, wearing this white blouse with a huge water stain over my chest. My grandmother and father were in the audience. This was my chance to prove to them I could act, that I was worthy of going off to New York City after school. Instead, I froze. I warbled out the tune, feeling the tension in the room rise with every note, feeling horribly exposed. After, I ran into an empty dressing room and crawled under the counter, crying my eyes out. "Oh, Maxine, I'm so sorry." Eventually, the door opened, and I hoped it might be my grandmother. But no, it was Arthur. He didn't say a word, just sat on the floor with me and placed a hand on my ankle. My ankle, of all places. The pressure of his hand had been wonderfully warm and calming, like he was staunching the flow of my shame. Once I was okay, we headed out the back door and found a diner and drank milkshakes. And that was that. I could tell Hazel wanted to ask more questions about why I tolerated Arthur's bad behavior, about his marriage. But I didn't want to discuss it and ruin all those lovely memories. Back in the kitchen, Mrs. Ripley was wiping Mr. Ripley's chin. Even though she was a loud, brash woman, the way she gently cleaned her husband, dabbing at the corners of his mouth, moved me. I wondered if Arthur would take care of me like that, if it came down to it, and regretted my earlier harsh words. "Where did you girls get off to?" asked Mrs. Ripley. "I was just showing Maxine around the apartment," said Hazel. "We really should go, though. It's been a busy day."
"Can't be that busy. It's not as if you have to memorize any lines since you're not acting anymore."
Mrs. Ripley finally acknowledged the play we were both working so hard on. "A director has just as much work, if not more." Mrs. Ripley stepped forward and planted a kiss on Hazel's forehead, her hands on either side of her cheeks.
"I just wish you were on stage with Maxine, not hiding in the back of the theater."
Hazel shook free.
"I'm not hiding in the back of the theater. That's not what directors do."
I couldn't help myself.
"Your daughter runs the show. She gets paid more money than the actors, gets to say what she wants and how she wants it. You really ought to be impressed."
"A lady director? I don't know." Hazel placed her hands on her mother's shoulders and stared hard into her eyes.
"I am the boss, Mother. You get it? Just like George Abbott. Moss Hart."
Her mother began to say something smart, but Hazel shook her head.
"No more dismissing this. It's a big deal. You can come to opening night, but only if you are there to be pleasant and say nice things to me, period. Otherwise, you can stay home."
Her mother frowned, but remained quiet. Hazel swept away, grabbing our coats and hats from the rack in a fluid motion and letting the front door bang hard behind us. As we walked outside, she hugged me.
"Thank you."
"You were great. Your best role yet."
"Believe me, I wasn't acting."
She took a deep breath, pleased with herself.
"Now it's your turn. Next time you see Arthur, you tell him what's what. I've got your back."
If it were only that easy. But I didn't say that. I just nodded and whistled for a taxi. Mr. Canby pulled me aside at rehearsal the next day. Not just aside, he yanked me into the house manager's office near the front of the theater, kicked out the house manager, and closed the door.
"Am I fired?"
I was only half joking, but Mr. Canby laughed hard and loud. Nervous laughter. Forced.
"No, of course not." I'd hoped he might have some news about Floyd, but I was wrong.
I have a favor to ask of you, Miss Meade. I've arranged a meeting with you and an important person, someone whose approval is crucial to our little play here.
An investor?
Not quite. After that disastrous radio interview, he reached out, saying he wants assurance that all is on the up and up. I'm hoping you can tell him that it is.
Strange choice of words. I was intrigued.
Isn't Hazel the right person for this? No, I want star power. You need to dazzle him with your Hollywood glitter.
Darn, I forgot to pack it in my handbag this morning. More fake laughter. Whoever this guy was, he had Mr. Canby shaking in his shoes.
No need to mention it to Hazel. She has enough on her plate as it is. He's at the Pierre Hotel.
Swanky. How will I know who he is?
Just ask for Lawrence Butterfield.
Now it was all coming into focus. This is the Butterfield with the supermarket empire? The same lunatic who crusades against commie sympathizers? Mr. Canby blanched.
Please, don't put it like that. Look, he heard the radio broadcast and is threatening the show with picketers, and I was hoping you could convince him to back off.
Why don't you have Hazel meet him and let them talk like two grown-ups? I bet she'd love a chance to put him straight.
First of all, that's the last thing we need. You know Hazel will go on the attack, like she did during the interview.
Can you blame her?
No, no, of course not. But we need a level head. Butterfield's got a direct line to a lot of people at the top, including the FBI.
I knew he was thinking of Floyd, and I knew I'd do whatever I could to help. While I hated going behind Hazel's back, I could see Mr. Canby's point. The somber clerk behind the desk at the Pierre directed me to a suite on the 30th floor, where a woman sporting a bouffant hairdo that resembled cotton candy dipped in ink opened the door. "Please come in," she said, without a trace of welcome. I followed her into the living area, where a slight man with a crew cut sat reading the newspaper. He folded it up carefully as he saw me coming, and we sussed each other out. His suit was too large for his frame, as if he was trying to emphasize shoulders he did not have. His profile disappointed further, with a chin that receded into his neck. But when he stuck out his hand, an entirely different energy emanated from that skinny scaffolding. His grip was firm, and he spoke with a baritone that almost rattled the teacup next to him.
"I'm Larry Butterfield. Pleasure to meet you, Miss Meade."
"Likewise." He ordered his wife to pour us tea, and she did so, before leaving the room and closing the door quietly behind her.
"Miss Meade, I'll get right to the point. I was listening to my favorite radio show and was very disappointed."
"How so, Mr. Butterfield?"
"Don't get me wrong. You were marvelous. I've seen a few of your movies and enjoyed them very much. But I didn't like what I heard from that director girl."
"I'm sorry to hear that. But you see..." He cut me off.
"Canby says you know Hazel Ripley quite well, professionally and personally."
"Yes. We met in the war, in Naples. She's a talented actress and a skilled writer."
"I see. Her show... Your show opens soon. I'm surprised you'd be involved, a movie actress of your stature."
"Have you read it?"
"I don't need to read it. I already know everything I need to know about it."
Mr. Butterfield took a sip of tea and pursed his lips. Or maybe that was his usual tea-tasting face.
"Canby's making a huge mistake. Don't think I don't know what he's up to. Sending along a pretty gal to try to convince me otherwise. Let me tell you, your playwright/director is not to be trusted."
"Hazel? She's one of the best people I know."
"I'll tell you a secret."
He leaned in close. I had to stop myself from recoiling.
She reminds me of my wife back when we first met.
That made no sense at all. The mousy woman who let me in?
She was a journalist, wrote about garden clubs and the like, before getting caught up in the women's right to vote, with all that pseudo-political grandstanding. When I asked for her hand in marriage, I explained I wouldn't tolerate any of that rubbish. And now she's a proper wife, a proper mother.
I tried to keep my expression neutral, not let on how horrified I was. The way the story spilled off his tongue, it was obvious he told it frequently.
I know a thing or two about the world that you ladies simply cannot, by virtue of your sex. I fought in the First World War. I was considered a war hero, if you must know. And after the war, I told Coolidge to keep an eye on those Germans. I told that to anyone who would listen, but no one believed me. Proved right, I was, and before we knew it, we were immersed in another world war.
He stared out the window, where clouds scudded across the sky.
For years now, my gut has been telling me that the Russians are next, and every day I'm proven right a little more. This time, I won't just talk. This time, I'm taking action to stop our country from attack.
This clearly wasn't a man to be underestimated. I tried a different tack. I appreciate your service, sir. I can only imagine the things you've seen. But we're just trying to put on a play, a little entertainment. I promise it's not an attack against America. Not in the least. He shook his head.
I've been working closely with the American Legion, and we believe there is a terrible threat out there, a threat to our very way of life. We've seen the impact of the Hollywood Ten. We know that these tainted artists have infiltrated television and radio. Broadway is next.
If I may, Mr. Butterfield, what was the last show you attended on Broadway? He rolled his eyes.
Oh, I couldn't possibly recall the title. It was years ago. My wife and I don't enjoy the theater as a general rule. Matter of fact, several years ago, a local theater group in Syracuse tried performing some lefty propaganda, and the minute I got wind of what they were up to, I had the entire production shut down. The group banned. I vowed to my wife that we would never step foot in a theater again.
I took a deep breath and remembered why Mr. Canby had sent me. Not to fight, but to flatter. Tell me what you're trying to do here in New York, if you don't mind. I'm not sure I understand exactly. He brightened at the invitation.
I've made it my mission to ensure that Red Channels is in every advertising executive's desk drawer up and down Madison Avenue. If they hire or represent someone who's on that list,